So I sent in a letter, literally with nothing else. I mailed a letter that said, hey, my name is Annie. Like, I applied to your school. I'm going to be successful no matter what, but I think you made a big mistake in not accepting me. And the day that I graduated high school, they emailed me, you're in.
My name is Esprit Devorah, host of the Women in Tech Show. The show means a lot to me. The reason why I wanted to create the Women in Tech Show is I wanted to create a positive piece of content, something where people can listen and say, if she can do it, so can I. I call it actionable empowerment. Every single episode, you'll hear the story of a fantastic woman in tech, from engineers to founders to investors to journalists to designers, all sorts of different females in tech who have thrived. I want to share their stories with you so that you can know what resources, mentors, and life situations they accessed in order to get to where they are today. Enjoy.
Welcome back to the Women in Tech podcast here in Austin, Texas. I love this town. I've been here, I think, 9 times or something like that. I am guilty of going to South by Southwest, one of the most incredible tech conferences in the world. But this time I get to be in Austin at non-conference season, and I've never loved it more. I'm sorry for everybody in LA, but I think I like Austin a little bit better than Los Angeles. Hello, Annie.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being on the Women in Tech podcast. So go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Annie Klomhaus. I'm the Vice President of Operations at New Knowledge. New Knowledge is a cybersecurity company that focuses or protects companies from the viral spread of disinformation. So we work with brands and protect them from manipulated, coordinated attacks across social media.
How did you get into this?
So I was one of those people that majored in something maybe not practical, but right. ended up coming full circle to be, you know, my true passion and something I get to focus on every day. So I went to the University of California at Berkeley, and I majored in political science and right. history. So, you know, what are you going to do when you graduate with those degrees if you don't want to be a lawyer?
You go work in cybersecurity?
Exactly. No. We're getting there. So I went into finance for 3 years. That seems like the most practical thing to do after getting yeah. those degrees. And through my experience working in finance, I founded my own company called Bell Gray, which is curated workflows for women. It was the idea that once you outgrow Banana Republic and Taylor, where you shop, if
yeah.
you're an investment banker or a lawyer or a woman that's wearing a suit every day, yeah. there's not any options.
So. Wait, what happened to that?
Yeah. So I did that for 2 years.
How long ago was this?
About 8 months ago.
So this is pretty recent.
Yeah. So I did that for 2 years. It was doing really well. We had a bunch of customers and sales and employees. It was tech-enabled retail. So
right.
we had a platform where we'd source from department stores and you could, you know, buy everything on Belgrade and check out there. And it would all come from different places.
Right.
So kind of that was going really well, but then the platform that enabled that technology went out of business pretty much overnight. Had to shut down.
Wait, so this is kind of like when someone builds their business on top of a platform like Facebook or something, and then all of a sudden Facebook changes how they function, and just overnight you can't exist anymore. The features that you had one day disappear the next day.
Kind of, yeah. That was the runway, or the idea of it, to have an MVP out there. It wasn't perfect. It was never the end goal. It was just to get enough customers and traction.
But you had the traction.
Mm-hmm. But not enough to justify. I mean, with retail, it's really risky. You don't want to, you know, raise $1 million and buy clothes for one season and not sell that one season and
right.
you're done. So
yeah.
this was kind of taking the risk out of that way and
yeah.
lowering the barrier to entry, which is amazing.
Yeah.
So without the technology, we couldn't even have started in the first place.
Yeah.
So I'm not really that bitter.
Yeah.
It was just poor timing. If it had shut down like a year later, we totally could have justified and had the data to
right.
do an informed buy. But just didn't make sense with timing.
But how interesting, you went straight back into a normal job.
Kind of.
I mean, was that a hard decision? Did you sit there thinking about it?
I definitely, with what I wanted to do next,
yeah.
I knew I wanted to do something really mission-aligned. Like, what I loved about doing Belgrade was I was really passionate. I woke up every day, and I was like, how can I empower this investment banker,
yeah.
this lawyer, this woman that, you know, may or may not be the only woman in the room a lot of the times
so yeah.
to feel like a total badass?
Yeah.
Like, that really motivated me, and I was really excited. to serve that person.
Right.
So when I was looking for my next kind of career move, I knew that I wanted something really mission aligned and mission driven. And that's how I found New Knowledge. Because what they're doing is also changing the world with a different customer. But I have that same feeling of waking up every day and getting to make the world a better place. So that's kind of how I found New Knowledge.
No, totally. My team and I talk about that all the time. We are LA Tech, my company in Los Angeles. We're so focused on culture. And culture plays a huge part in attracting people. Were there, like, you were attracted not necessarily to cybersecurity, you were attracted to the culture of the company providing the value of cybersecurity.
Yeah, and we get to work on really cool things. Our CEO before at New Knowledge was advising the State Department on how ISIS recruits on Twitter.
What?
Yeah. So stopping that.
What?
So we work with brands as well as different political companies and help them understand when they're being targeted by trolls or people that are really trying to take down their brand for like a malicious reason.
Yeah.
So we get to kind of be the guardians of democracy.
And how did you get your start? Like, did you have technology in your house growing up or when did you first fall in love with technology?
I think I was always just an entrepreneur type personality. When I was little, I wanted to be president when I grew up. So, or the boss or
you
something.
You can still be president.
It's not too late for that. So I think that I always just had I moved around a lot growing up, and I kind of had that just jump right in and take risk mentality since I was, 2 years old.
Right.
So I knew that I would be successful in startups and always kind of liked that idea.
And like, I think you make it sound so easy to go from having your own company to jumping into like a normal job, regardless that the culture and the mission is amazing. I mean, what kind of questions did you ask yourself or was it really that easy for you where you were just able to jump lifestyles?
No, it was not that easy. I mean, it's hard letting go of your own company. It took a while to wind down and really like let it go. And still, I joke, if I won the lottery tomorrow, I'd probably still do it again.
Yeah.
But I mean, I did think about, do I want to go to a more established company, especially after coming in from finance, which is very established and very large and bureaucratic. But there was a lot that I didn't like about that. But it was a struggle of, do I want to get on this crazy roller coaster again?
Yeah.
Or do I want to just kind of have a normal job?
Yeah.
And I thought about it for a while because it's, you get burned after, failing a company.
Yeah.
But
you get burned even when you're not failing. It's exhausting being an entrepreneur.
Exactly. So I think it was a difficult decision, and I did have multiple offers on the table, but ultimately I couldn't turn down something that was just mission aligned and just changing the world for a stable job. And I definitely made the right decision because I still have that energy and I wake up really excited every day and passionate about what I'm doing. And I think that would be the hardest thing to not have.
Which says so much about New Knowledge. What about your startup was called Bell Gray.
Mm-hmm.
What about Bell Gray? Like, what did you learn that you were able to take to New Knowledge to be an even more effective teammate there?
Yeah. I mean, everything pretty much. I think I had like the best combination of backgrounds from like a corporate job as well as a startup.
Right.
Because half of our company now is like NSA veterans and the other half are software engineers.
Yeah.
So it's a really good mix of kind of, I think, my backgrounds as well.
Right.
But I mean, I learned how to do everything for Bell Gray. That's the fun part about being an entrepreneur. You get to learn about sales. You get to learn about marketing. You get to learn about recruiting. You get to learn about finance. You get to learn about, everything touches you. And that's what my job is now as the VP of operations. I get to have my hand in every single department. And if I hadn't done it and also just learned, I think the biggest thing I learned about starting Bell Gray was you should never pay someone to do something if you can at least try and do it yourself first.
Yeah.
So that's like a really good lesson, if you think like, oh, I don't know how to make, graphic assets, like just give it a go. See if you can figure it out.
Right.
Like, Google it.
Use Canva.
Like there are tools out there that empower non-professionals and it kind of gives you that like mentality that it doesn't always have to be 100% perfect. If you're doing kind of everything in your generalist role like me, as long as you're moving the company forward every day, that's the most important thing you can be doing. And that's what I learned at Bell Gray that I take to my job now.
What's so interesting though is, I mean, in the startup efficiency kind of movement, it's about delegate, delegate, delegate. So when do you make that choice between my time, even though I could do it, shouldn't be invested this way versus it's more cost efficient or better for the overall picture for my time to be invested doing it myself? How do you make that choice? Which ones do you keep? Which ones do you let go?
Yeah. I mean, I think delegating is hard. And I know I think stereotypically that women have a more difficult time delegating than men.
Yeah.
It is definitely something that's really important to scaling. So I kind of like have to remind myself that it's important to delegate like all the time. It doesn't just happen naturally. I'm not just like a shove it down the road type of person. So it's definitely just like a conscious thing that's in my head all the time.
Right.
I'm like, don't always have to do this yourself. There are tools and there's other people out there.
Yeah. You know what I realized just now as talking what an entrepreneurial superpower is? Never occurred to me. You've probably heard this before, but I just thought of it now. The best entrepreneur is probably someone who's entirely lazy.
Like, probably.
Like, I completely want to be an entrepreneur, but I am just lazy and I'm not going to not be lazy. So I'm just going to delegate the whole thing.
Maybe after you have customers and money. It's easy to be lazy, but I don't think that's a good quality when you're starting. You're starting a company from scratch. Maybe a good CEO is lazy.
Yeah. What it's very funny. What's your day-to-day look like? You're the VP of operations.
Yeah. Wake up super early. I try and like I'm super organized person, so I like spend every night and every morning going through my to-do list and like reorganizing, reprioritizing, thinking about what I can delegate.
She was early too, you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just an early person.
Which was nice. I appreciate it because it throws me off on the schedule when someone's late, so it was great. Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of take that hour early in the morning to think about kind of the priorities every single day and making sure I'm spending my day most efficiently.
Right.
And then honestly, I'm in meetings all day.
Yeah.
So starting at 9 until 5, I'm pretty much in meetings.
Yeah.
Meeting with the leadership or meeting with different, you know, different teams and like figuring out how they're running their teams and thinking about how they could be more efficient. And then I kind of start my to-do list and my tasks at like 5 o'clock. And I'll usually do that till about 9. And then hang out with friends.
I was just going to say, one, I love that you balance yourself in that way. That's something that's really difficult for me and something I'm consistently working on. But let's talk about meetings for a little bit, because some companies, I won't mention who, are notorious for having useless meetings. And then I find sometimes that meetings are where that creative brainstorming happens to move things forward, but then you have to have an execution plan immediately thereafter. Is part of your job overseeing the meetings, so you have to do it, or how? What's your take on an efficient meeting?
I'm actually a big proponent of agendas and to-do lists and action items. I'm always like, we're whiteboarding during meetings. We're making sure there's like clear action items afterwards. Yeah. I think my biggest problem is I'm like too like by the book. And I, you know, it's like I need to stop sometimes and be like more creative because I'm so execution focused.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, sometimes people just need to talk and like let them talk. And I'm like, no, let's go. What does this lead to? And what are we doing? And
yeah.
So I think I kind of, it's the opposite problem for me. I need to like slow down and brainstorm more.
I would love your take on this. So how many people typically are in your meetings? Is it like 8 people? Is it 2 people? Is it 15 or 50?
It's usually on average about 4 people on average.
And are they the same 4 people or always different?
Always different.
So I would love to talk about the personalities in meetings and how everyone has a different one, a different personality. I mean, as a leader, what do you do to kind of navigate around communication styles depending on who you're speaking with? And I'm just thinking about my own meetings, and sometimes I'm just like, that's not how I would handle this meeting. And I'm feeling like this 15 minutes isn't really a good use of time, but it seems really important to that person. How do you set boundaries within meetings? And
I think that is an important thing. That the fact that you're even aware of that already makes like you probably better at running meetings than most people. But I think just really being aware of the different personality types and knowing, okay, if this person likes to talk and likes to be heard, like just for me, I've put an agenda in advance and kind of think about like, okay, if this person just wants to like touch base or check in, like that's what they need to do their job more efficiently and better, and I need to empower them. And I kind of just see myself as just as long as I'm moving the company forward in any way, whatever that looks like, it's productive.
Yeah.
So I kind of just take that mindset. If like someone needs to talk for 15 minutes just to catch up and that's part of their meeting that they need.
Yeah.
Like everybody has different needs.
Yeah.
And you just have to be really aware of the different personality types.
Yeah.
We take a personality test at New Knowledge and share that kind of those findings with different people. And I always try and keep that in mind when I'm talking to people.
Yeah.
Like some people just like to be heard. People know that I like to not necessarily talk that much. So they're not going to like it kind of goes both ways.
And it's interesting that you say that because someone else who does talk a lot may interpret your not talking as something. So to have the awareness that everybody communicates in a different style doesn't necessarily have a significance on the value of the intel being shared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember when I just graduated college and knew nothing about the working world or all those lessons you learn kind of in that first year, like how to write an email, how to be an adult. One of the cool things that the firm I was working at did was we did take personality tests, and then we talked about how certain personalities see other personalities.
Right.
And I think I was 90 or 100% extroverted. So I'm very extroverted. And there was someone on my team who I thought wasn't very nice.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out why this person didn't like me or what was going on. Yeah. And I didn't get it.
Yeah.
They never wanted to talk. And so I took the test and I was sitting next to this person and they were, you know, 0% extroverted or 100% introverted. Right. And it said like, oh, extroverts typically view introverts as standoffish and cold. And I was like, oh, they're not actually mean. I just don't understand their personality type. Like they're actually just shy.
Yeah.
And like as a 22-year-old, that kind of like, clicked, and it all kind of came into focus. And I was like, okay, well, it's not like just because people are, you know, a certain way. It's probably how I'm viewing them as someone who is the way I am.
Yeah.
So I've definitely taken that with me, and that was an interesting lesson to learn.
Those clicks are the best. Oh my gosh. I picture like what is the gear. Yeah. I'm like, oh yeah, it's getting better. Let's talk more about new knowledge and like who are the customers that they serve?
Yeah. So we have like Fortune 100 customers across all different industry verticals like entertainment, finance, agriculture, energy, and then as well as like political clients, which makes sense given the nature of fake news and all that's going on right now.
And just to reinforce, like, what is the value that you're doing for these clients?
So there's so much out there on the internet, like a human eye can't really determine like what is going on or understand, you know, if you're an executive at one of these large companies, like you can't really understand like what's real and what's fake, especially in this day and age. Like as we're looking at online, it's just not the same. So we have a technology way of looking at it as opposed to a human eye, kind of removing that human eye aspect and crunching like all the giant data out there.
Right.
And then you can say like, okay, this movement is really easy to see is not grassroots. Like these aren't your fans. Like don't listen to these people. Because this is affecting, you know, corporate strategy. If you see 100,000 people protesting your brand, like that's like, oh shit, we should pay attention to that. But if you have a company like New Knowledge, I can tell you right away, like in real time, like, no, that's fake. Those are all fake accounts, and that's someone trying to push their agenda and trying to influence your brand. Like, that's a really scary world to live in, that people are reacting. You know, like, the way I like to think about it is everybody has, you know, in America, like, we all have the right to one voice. It's so important to our democracy, and freedom of speech is the most important thing ever. You don't have the right to an army of bots to shape public opinion. And that's really scary when one person can amplify their voice like that, and a human eye can't detect what's going on.
Whoa. Oh my gosh. Now I'll be all paranoid the rest of the day.
I mean, I get really paranoid now. I'm completely off social media since starting.
Are you?
I am.
Wait, tell me more about that. Wait, so you had Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all these things, and now you don't have those?
Mm-hmm. I don't.
No,
I
for real?
Yeah, for real.
Like you deleted them?
I've deleted them.
Let's get it. Why? Well, other than like it's great to have your life back, but like why?
Well, I was getting paranoid, kind of like what you were saying. Like the second like you start to like believe these a lot of things that are like could be real people aren't real people. And there's no way a human eye can understand that. It's really like a technological thing. And once you plug in the technology, it's like so clear, like what's a human, what's not a human. But I think I deleted them. I mean, first of all, because I was paranoid because of New Knowledge.
Yeah.
And all the things that I've learned about the internet and the dark web since starting. But also just I think it was kind of like a personal thing with work getting so crazy and fast paced. Like we're always checking our emails, like checking. And social media is just another thing that you have to like check.
Completely agree.
And it's like a to-do list thing.
Yeah.
Like a compulsion. So just removing it, now I take like when I'm sitting somewhere and I'm not doing work emails or I'm like waiting for a friend who's 5 minutes late, like normally I would just open up social media and look at it. But now I just sit there and I just like look out the window.
So it's like you're living in the 80s.
Yeah, it's like so retro.
The thing that I'm processing though is And what's so frustrating to me, so of course, having a podcast about tech and needing to use all the social media channels even to like get the podcast out there, right? What's frustrating to me is that like our status is defined now by social media, which is like even a false status because you could have bots buy your status, yeah. But yet a status where there's things that you can't even get into something unless you have like 100,000 influencers following mm-hmm. or something. And I hate that kind of power mm-hmm. or like false value, or maybe it is value. I don't know. I just don't like it.
Well, and then you can't understand it. We can't quantify it.
I just think,
what is the value?
I just think it sucks that like someone's not valuable unless they have like a ton of people following them on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Like that's just bullshit. But in the same extent, that is how our society is moving forward. So even though I'm absolutely envious of you not having any, ma'am, like I'm the type of girl that I backpacked without a computer or phone for 5 months. Like I'm super into like no social, no technology. But I also understand that it's so important for
right now.
So how do you do that? Like, are you, and I hope I'm not planting paranoid thoughts, but like, are you nervous like later, like will you need those things again to move forward, or you're just like, I'm not really too concerned
in my career
it. Yeah,
for my career, no. I mean, you know, I just have, I mean, that's actually like the biggest difference I think with Belgrade, New Knowledge Belgrade.
I was just
like
gonna say, even Belgrade
how, I was all over social media all the time, so totally know what you mean, like the value of influence, and I was just, you know, having to be obsessed with that world.
And you had about to. It wasn't a choice. That's what I'm saying.
And I wanted to like delete it then, but it's just like I couldn't. That would be brand suicide. But luckily with New Knowledge, because we have, it's a different kind of branding and messaging.
Yeah,
we don't need to engage with a massive audience.
Yeah.
We know we're mainly talking to execs, and execs aren't checking our social media page. So it is freeing, and that is nice. But I think, and then personally for my career, I don't think that having a social media following gets you really any value.
Yeah.
But it is a luxury that you get to have at certain jobs, but not all jobs. I mean, your job, you could never just unplug. Maybe.
Yeah.
You could start the trend.
So I do try. Like, I do little things like I have a Facebook account that's just for business. So if I want to deactivate my personal account, my team can still log in. Because, you know, Facebook connects everything to your personal profile. So I've, with intent, always made sure that I can unplug if I want to. But, yeah, like, the larger that we get, the harder it is.
Yeah, I don't even remember how we got on this in the first place.
Yeah.
But
because you were talking about an army of bots, and you were talking about how because of this army of bots and the power that like malicious social has, you're like, I just deactivated everything, and I'm just like, oh my God, I'm so jealous, but I don't think it's possible for most of us.
Yeah, it's definitely, deactivating is not the answer. That was more for personal reasons, but it is true, and it's here to stay. It's not going away. I don't think that. But I do think that there has to be companies like New Knowledge, and people will pop up to help understand all that's going on in this world. But I mean, it is pretty scary, and it is a reality that we live in. And you know, the way we talk about what we do is kind of like, remember when the internet first happened and there was fraud, and that was absolutely terrifying, and people couldn't understand it at all, like the concept of fraud. You know, someone stealing your credit card online was just really scary to most Americans that didn't understand even how the internet worked.
Yeah.
And that kind of felt probably like how disinformation and fake news feels right now. You know, there was no norms around it. Nobody understood it. There was no laws.
Yeah.
And then slowly we started to understand, like it became like a social norm. Like you understand what it means. You know, cybersecurity firms popped up.
Right.
Now every large firm has a cybersecurity.
Yeah.
Like, office, which they didn't have before.
Right.
And there was kind of created new norms, and then legislation was written, and people kind of wrapped their head around it. So I think that's what's going to happen with disinformation on social media across all the platforms is, you know, companies will start to understand it more as we talk about it more as a society.
Yeah.
There will eventually be legislation written around it. We'll wrap our heads around it. Companies will now have new departments that focus on disinformation on social media and combating it the same way we combat fraud.
Yeah.
So I think the future isn't that scary. I just think we're in the intermediate time and private companies like New Knowledge yeah. are going to drive that change, not the government.
It's interesting. Obviously, I'm just one girl and you work with like these huge companies. But I remember it was I think it was 2016 or something around there. This mainstream newspaper wrote about me without me knowing, and it was all made up. And it was the day that I realized the internet is fake. Like, and I was just like, wait, I know about this article because it's my life and it's not true. And I'm like, oh my gosh. I was like, what's the point of the internet? Like, I can't yeah. trust anything.
Well, how do you defend yourself against that too? Especially when they have a large platform and if yeah. you don't have any yeah. social media followers.
And luckily it wasn't yeah. too bad and I knew it yeah. would fade. It wasn't a big deal at all. But it was just like this really uncomfortable awareness how just I can't trust what I read online.
And then imagine if you're someone with an agenda and you want to take down a certain movement or a brand. Yeah. It's really easy to put an article out there, use a bot network to disseminate it, get that hashtag trending, and then a real reporter might see the hashtag trending, pick up on it, write about it, and it's become real news off something that one person can make up.
Because journalists aren't journalists anymore.
I think what they also need new tools because they don't want to write about this stuff. And they would be very embarrassed if they found out that they're writing about something that wasn't real news. But they cannot possibly know
yeah.
if that is real or not. If they see, hundreds of thousands of people talking about it, they don't know with an eyeball that those are bots. It's not yeah. – I don't really, like, blame them. But I think that they need tools to understand, like, what it is they're really writing about and
yeah.
looking at.
Yeah. It's an interesting and world new norms. We live in. Mm-hmm. This new knowledge that we have. I love to ask, what's your favorite book, personal or professional or both?
So I love all fantasy novels. Yeah. Our office is also very big into fantasy novels. Yeah. The Lord of the Rings Slack conversations we have go on for days. So I think, I'm pretty big fan of the Harry Potter series. Those are my yeah. favorite books.
I've never read one.
Really?
Yeah. Can you believe it?
That's like probably.
I also haven't seen any of the movies.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
it's like I'm not living in this world. What is your favorite like productivity software or app or could be anything?
My favorite one. I mean, I use Asana right now a lot just for my own personal life. And I think I could probably not live without that because writing a to-do list on a piece yeah. of paper would be a pain.
Yeah. It's interesting that you chose Asana versus Trello versus Basecamp versus Infinity.
Infinity. Yeah. I just like Asana.
Yeah. It's cool. And what's one obstacle that you've overcome successfully and what did you learn from it?
I think it's really, I know this is going to sound so cheesy, but embracing failure and being proud of it. Like I've had so many failures in my life. And that's one question I always ask when I'm interviewing people for any tech firm. It's like, tell me about a time that you failed and how did you handle it? Because I want them to not feel like, I want them to, first of all, to have a real story. Because if right. people say, well, I was going to be pre-med and then I switched to software engineering. And I'm like, okay, that was not a failure. I think, I mean, one of the biggest like failures that I kind of defines like me in the beginning of my career was my dream was to go to UC Berkeley. Yeah. I don't know why, but I was just like, that was my dream school. I grew up in Hong Kong and Singapore and
yeah. Thanks for waiting till the end of the podcast interview to just throw that in. All right.
Yeah. So I grew up in Asia, and then for some reason, California and Berkeley was just like the end all be all. Yeah. That's where I wanted to go to school. And I applied, obviously, from out of state. I wasn't from California, which at the time was very hard to get in, and I got rejected.
Yeah.
And there is no wait list at Cal. It's just you're in or you're out, and it's a giant bureaucratic school. And so I like read the fine print at the bottom, like the last trick. If you feel like something has significantly changed about your life, you have the right to appeal your rejection. So I sent in a letter, literally with nothing else. I mailed a letter that said, hey, my name is Annie. Like, I applied to your school. I'm going to be successful no matter what, but I think you made a big mistake in not accepting me. And the day that I graduated high school, they emailed me, you're in.
So, get out.
Just from one letter. And I think that was like a really important life lesson as far as like failure in business, which is if you really want something, like don't let no ever stop you. And sending something as like simple as a letter or appealing a rejection whatever it is, you never know, like, what that could have, I mean, I didn't expect to get an offer. I was pretty surprised, to be honest.
Yeah.
But just as little gestures like that and just kind of having that attitude, I think, has always made me successful in what I want and pursuing that. And I think makes people in tech successful, just like embracing it. Like, yeah, I didn't get in. I'm like, that's not going to stop me from trying again.
I love that story. And we can't wrap it up without me knowing, how did you grow up in Asia? What was that about?
I was there for my dad's job. We moved when I was two. And I've moved schools every 2 years my entire life.
No.
Until Cal, which I was at for 3 years. I graduated in 3 years. But yeah, so I've kind of lived all over the world. We were in Hong Kong, Singapore, Hong Kong, and then I ended up going to boarding school in Connecticut, and then my family's in D.C. and New York and L.A. and Idaho was in there in the mix, and then I lived in San Francisco. So
amazing.
Definitely been all over, and I think that's added to the resilience as well.
Totally. How many languages do you speak?
English. That's very embarrassing.
Really? That's
it? I took Mandarin for 11 years, which is, and I can pretty much just say ni hao.
It's just not your thing?
No, I wish it was. But in Hong Kong, when I was living there, it was actually still a British colony. So English was the first language. And then on the island, they speak Cantonese. And yeah. In the schools, they teach Mandarin because that's the language that business has done it.
Right.
But if you try and speak Mandarin to someone on the island, they'll just respond to you in English.
Oh, wow.
So it's about as useful, I say, as knowing Spanish in America at the time. That is no longer the case. It has since changed. But unfortunately, it wasn't a need to know to get around, which I think is the most important motivator in learning a language.
Yeah, no, it's true. Where can people find you online?
Newknowledge.com.
And how can they get in touch with you? As I said that, I'm like, okay, she doesn't have any social profiles. So newknowledge.com, an email, or I don't even know. I've never been faced with this, like,
no social media,
like,
don't at me.
Obliteration.
I don't exist. and anyone can email me. My email address is annie@newknowledge.io.
Cool.
I'm old fashioned. Send me an email. It's pretty much like an old school letter at this point.
I dig it. Annie, thank you so much for hanging out with the Women in Tech podcast and for, I had one more question when you were talking about moving so much. I'm so glad I remembered it at the last second. What's one tip you can give everybody about how to make new friends?
That's a great question.
You had to move every 2 years. That's insane. As a child.
I think that gets to another thing, which is the imposter syndrome that people talk a lot about entrepreneurs. So every time I moved and made friends, I just found the coolest kids, whatever place I lived, and tried to copy them, which has changed drastically. Like in Hong Kong, what was really cool was very different than what was really cool in Idaho.
Right.
So I think that kind of just made me a chameleon of the world. And I think it's just being vulnerable and trying to copy someone that's not yourself. Like, okay, I'm going to be this, country girl now that can jump off a cliff and go backpacking. And even though I'm from Hong Kong and don't even own a sweater.
Yeah.
No, now I'm going to be this badass backpacking girl. And just kind of being vulnerable like that is the best way to make friends. It's throwing yourself out there and trying to embrace what the culture is that you're immersed in and not being above it, essentially.
Totally. Thank you, Annie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's been awesome sharing this conversation with you on the Women in Tech podcast. If you want to connect with more extraordinary women in tech around the world, if you do happen to be on social media, go to womenintechvip.com. It takes you straight to the Facebook group. That's womenintechvip.com. Remember to say hello at Women in Tech Show on social. It feels so weird talking about the social when you have no social. On Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, at Women in Tech Show. I will talk to you guys, hear you guys, see you guys in the next episode. Bye.
Hi, this is Annie Klomhaus, Vice President of Operations at New Knowledge. Based in Austin, Texas, New Knowledge defends your brand against disinformation. You're listening to Women in Tech.
Impact Hub here in Austin, Texas has been our home. We want to give a huge thanks to making it possible for us to comfortably meet and interview several inspiring women in tech. They have the most collaborative workspace, incredible events, beautiful design, a hammock in their backyard. What? It's an incredible space. You have to check it out if you're in Austin. Thank you so much for being a part of the Women in Tech journey. Be sure to go to impacthubaustin.com to get your free day of co-working. I want to give a huge thanks to the team at SpyCloud. SpyCloud protects your employee and customer information from breaches and account takeovers. Try SpyCloud's early warning breach detection platform. SpyCloud made it possible for us to meet with several women in tech here in Austin, Texas, and I am so thankful that they have been part of the Women in Tech podcast journey. Get protected today by going to spycloud.com. That's SPYCLOUD.com.